You asked if it was possible to have John for a few minutes to come and speak to you and be able to answer some questions. And I'm very grateful for him to take the time to come and be with us. John, as you probably know, is a practicing solicitor. He's been the provincial registrar to the Archbishop of Canterbury. He continues to do that. Legal advisor to the Anglican Council since 95. A variety of other things. He's helped with the Lambeth Commission in 2003 and 4. His book and working in terms of canon law has become a kind of a standard, I think, for the Anglican Communion. A whole bunch of other things that one could say, but rather than me speak, let me turn it to him.
Shall I just say something? I mean, not Please. All of you may have been there yesterday. When I was talking about the Constitution, I explained that essentially rewriting the Constitution was driven by concerns to do with English charity law. Charity law in England has moved on quite a lot since the first Constitution was written a good many years ago. And in particular, there was a Charities Act in 1993, and then there's been another one more recently in 2006. And each of those has had implications. But charity law generally has moved on quite a lot. And I think the members of the Standing Committee about 8 or 9 years ago became quite concerned about the level of personal liability that they were carrying, because the body was an unincorporated charity. And there are distinct advantages in turning charities which have got significant financial turnover, turning them into limited, what are called limited liability companies. Now, I won't, unless you want a discussion on English company law, I won't go into the detail of that. But there are advantages in doing it this way. And so what we were asked to do in starting in Dundee was to explore this. And then in Hong Kong, we began to unfold it. But we're asked specifically to try to produce something which retained the essential shape of the ACC as it has been since its inception, but to put it within the shell, if you like, of an incorporated company in English law. And that's essentially what's been done. There's been a bit of tidying up along the way as well. But you know, the essential shape and so on has been retained, so that things like the Standing Committee have retained their role. And, of course, alongside this, there were other issues, and one of those has been that for many years the Primates Standing Committee has met alongside the ACC Standing Committee. Although, strictly speaking, the Standing Committee of the Primates, I hope I'm not boring you, the Standing Committee of the Primates really were there almost as observers. And since actually it was very important that they did have a proper voice, it had seemed to me for a long time that these, in effect, two Standing Committees should be given legal status. And that was what was approved in Nottingham in 2005, and that is a separate set of issues. So you'll see that as a significant change between the two different versions of the Constitution. But it does mean now that we've got a Standing Committee with all the various approvals that were needed from the two-thirds of the constitutional bodies around the Communion in order to give legal effect to what has actually happened in practice for a good many years. But as I said yesterday, there have been moments when it's been a little bit difficult, because there have been momentous decisions to take, as, for example, with the acquisition of St Andrew's House, which carried very considerable financial liability for the members of the ACC Standing Committee. And, of course, the Primate Standing Committee, who had been meeting alongside them already for many years by then, clearly needed, their voice needed to be heard. But when it came to it, when it came to making the firm final decision, the liability rested with the members of the ACC Standing Committee, and so the Primates Standing Committee members had to leave the room for that decision to be made, because otherwise they could have swayed the decision in a way which would have had potentially unfortunate consequences for the members of the ACC Standing Committee. So now we've got past that and encapsulated the whole shape and structure within this shell, a legal shell of an incorporated company. So I hope that sort of it puts the thing in some sort of context for you. I'm sorry it's a bit boring, really, but, you know, I'm doing my best.
Chris, can we turn to you for a first question?
Yes, John, can I ask you a question about the status of the Joint Standing Committee in this new dispensation? ACC 14 has given a significant case study, as it were, of possible general practice, and I'd like your comment. A delegate has been seated who has violated the Windsor Report and the moratoria on the consecration of persons in same-sex relations. A delegate has not been seated by virtue of being the subject of a cross-border intervention in violation of, again, another moratoria. When the Secretary-General spoke with us on Monday, he indicated that the Constitution only spoke of qualified members and made no explicit provision for adjudicating on the content or evaluation of such qualifications. It just spoke of qualified members, but there was no content and no process for saying how those qualifications should be decided or implemented. Can you confirm that now the constitutionality of the JSC is the supreme body in the Anglican Communion to make these judgments, contradictory as they may appear in this case, since they overruled in one case the sovereignty and decision of the province of Uganda and in the other the Windsor Report? So can you comment on the status of the JSC, which appears to have overruled two elements of, one might say, authority in the Anglican Communion?
I'm not sure if that's a question or an essay, really. The new constitution makes no difference. I mean, you'll find the same sort of wording is that word about qualified appointments and so on is there in the new one too. The Joint Standing Committee meeting and making that decision, if it were faced with the same decision again, I would imagine would approach it on the same sort of basis. And the basis, the underlying basis, must be that as charity trustees, which they are under the existing arrangements and under the new arrangements, as charity trustees, they have an overriding duty to see that the overall purposes of the charity are sustained. And so if a decision was being made which appeared to be undermining the arrangements for the charity generally, then I would expect them to approach it in the same way on another occasion, in other contexts. And I mean, one's got to, you know, not be too constrained, I think, about what the duties of charity trustees are. I mean, I think they have got to be free to respond to circumstances as they arise, particularly in a developing context in which we are, where the sort of issues that are likely to arise over the next 20 years, say, we probably can't predict just now, but we do need to have power for them as charity trustees to do what they need to do in the light of circumstances as they then are.
And the overall purposes of the charity are?
Well, they are the advancement of the work of the Anglican Communion, to, you know, as a fellowship of churches.
Robert? Please identify yourself again if you don't mind, just for the...
I'm still processing. I'm going to ask.
This may be redundant, I don't know. But several years ago, you were working on a universal set of canons and constitutions for the Anglican Communion that seemed to have gone nowhere because the Episcopal Church particularly felt that no one was going to encroach on their understanding of that. Is that dead on arrival now? Will there ever be an attempt to find a universal set of canons and constitutions that everybody can sign on to, thus be subject to the discipline of what that would mean?
Well, thank you. I mean, that's a very interesting question. I'm rather glad you raised it, because I brought the booklet with me in case anybody thought it had disappeared. At the moment we're in the process of getting this information out. And just to be clear, the status of what's set out in these principles is not that it's supposed to be a kind of governing document for the way in which all provinces of the Communion must operate. Rather, it's an attempt to describe the way in which provinces in fact do operate, and to distill out of that some underlying principles insofar as they can be established. So it's not that it's dead in the water, I think that was the phrase you used, or dead on arrival. It's that what was launched in July or August last year at the Lambeth Conference was the opening up of a discussion about whether, in fact, these really are the underlying principles which can be found then encapsulated and worked out in each of the provinces of the Communion within their canons and constitution. And unfortunately, of course, these things take a long time to work through, and those of us who are involved in that process have also got one or two other things on our plates at the same time. But it certainly is an ongoing project, and one which is close to the hearts of quite a number of folk around the Communion.
Would it have teeth, this thing? I mean, would there be, if you did get a universal, would there be some disciplinary thing behind it all, or we would just assume these are nice things we can all look at and say, yes, that's nice, but it doesn't really affect how province A acts versus province B, and whether to incorporate, say, GAFCON or ACNA or any of those sort of things?
Well, I mean, the purpose of the exercise is not a disciplinary purpose. It's an educative purpose. The idea is so that people actually get to know what's going on in around the Communion, and they see the similarities, and then they can measure. If there are differences, they can measure those differences against what are perceived as the similarities within the document that is now on sort of public display. It's certainly not that you can hold them up and say, right, if your constitution doesn't conform to these principles, therefore you don't count as an Anglican. I mean, that isn't the case at all. It is educative in the sense of being able to look at your own constitution and say, yes, we identify with that, we can see that. And in some cases, it's actually very... It can have a direct bearing, because there are provinces, which I've had to deal with in the past, where the issues have arisen. And simply because their own constitution doesn't have provision for various things, they haven't really known how to deal with them. And this has come up in the case of clergy discipline, for example, in some parts of the world. And so what they've then done is to say, well, how do other people do it? Well, this is a resource for filling in those kind of gaps. But, of course, legally, juridically, in order to fill in those kind of gaps, say, on a clergy discipline type case, it would be necessary for the local jurisdiction to say, yes, this is something that we recognise. We may not have it written down yet, but we recognise that this is an appropriate way for an Anglican church to go about doing clergy discipline, and then they could enact that and embody that in their own structures. So it could have a direct usefulness in that way, but I think it has an indirect usefulness for many parts of the Communion as they look to see the commonality with many other churches.
Colin?
I'm going to go back to Chris's question. I understand UK charity law and that it expresses the purpose for which a body is set up. Yeah. So in this case, the Anglican Consultative Council. So you're saying that in the first case that Chris cited, the overruling of the sovereignty of somebody nominated from Uganda, that you deemed that person legally not to fulfil the purposes of the Anglican Consultative Council in...
It's a decision of the Joint Standing Committee, and they are the trustees who have to make these sort of decisions.
I mean, yeah.
And I think they're perfectly within their rights to do that, given their overriding duty to see that the overall purposes of the trust are fulfilled.
Mm. And that's the key distinctive
feature. I think that would be the, key fact.
Yeah.
Key fact.
Yes. Mary Justice.
No, I'm sorry, not. I'm still processing. Thanks.
Okay. Robert, we we passed by you. Last chance.
All right then. In this case, the formation of the Anglican Church in North America. In regards to the trustees of the JSC, looking towards the advancement of the work of the Anglican Communion. One could argue that the Anglican Church in North America would advance the work of the Anglican Communion. So therefore, would the Joint Standing Committee have the power to allow them a seat?
I think the point is, first of all, that body, as I understand it, legally may not yet be fully formed. I don't know exactly what the status of the body is. The process for any organization as a province to join the Anglican Consultative Council is set out in some guidelines that were published in Panama in 1996, and you'll find them in the report of that meeting. And I know that a number of key individuals who are associated with the North American operation have been alerted to that process. But as far as I'm aware, no formal steps have been taken to take that any further.
But as far as the Joint Standing Committees, you said they have an overall trust that they have to ensure the work of the Anglican Communion, and that in this particular case overrided the decision of the Church of Uganda, I guess... What I'm getting at is this, it seems like there's an elevated power of the JSC that they can override the Constitution or any ambiguities to what they deem necessary. Mm. And even if there's things set out, they seem to be overriding it and saying, well, this is to further the work of the Communion. So with that being the case, how could they view another Anglican entity in North America?
Well, they would have to make that decision against the background of the communion as it is at that time. And, I mean, I can't project how things...
Do that, in your opinion?
Well, the guidelines for taking those steps are set out in the 1996 guidelines. So, it's got to be assessed against that process. Now, that process is fairly elaborate... and as far as I'm aware, has not been begun.
We'll give Mary Frances the last question.
I'd like to ask you about some comments that were made yesterday by Bishop Cameron about property litigation. And he said that one can't be anything but aghast when Christians take each other to court as a way to settle their differences. I don't want to do a gotcha here, but speaking as a lawyer who advises the Anglican Communion on legal matters, could I ask you to reflect on that issue?
Yes. It's always, I think, deeply dismaying when Christians feel that they've got to resort to the courts in order to resolve issues that they can't resolve in other ways. I'm very conscious of all sorts of disputes, and not merely, I'm not only talking about the disputes that there have been in North America, but elsewhere in the world, where many efforts are made in order to resolve them through mediation and other processes. And I know that key leaders in the communion have worked enormously hard in order to resolve these matters without them going to court. But in the last resort, of course, the courts are there in order to resolve issues that, for whatever reason, can't be resolved elsewhere. And that's not to say that it's not dismaying when Christians find themselves at such an impasse that they can't actually resolve things between themselves. There are, of course, overriding legal issues which arise in certain jurisdictions, and I really can't comment on the detailed secular law in particular countries. But there do occasionally come points at which trustees have got to act in order to protect their trusts. And I can understand why, in certain cases, resort has to be had to the courts in order to do that. If those interests can't be protected in other ways, but it nevertheless remains, I think, deeply dismaying that Christians find themselves deeply in disagreement over some issues that they can't actually find a way through, which can result in these matters being resolved in a way which is mutually beneficial.
Thank you.
John, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.